Okay, good morning. Thank you for joining us on this Friday morning. We appreciate you taking the time to call in and join our In Conversation with Call. And I'm now going to turn it over to Dean Tomaselli.
Thank you, Pam. And again, welcome everybody, and thanks for being on the call today. I think we are truly beyond the peak of COVID-19 with around 100 patients still in our health system, but we are dealing with the aftermath that remains. And this aftermath has been highlighted by the disparate effects of COVID-19, primarily on our minority populations, and this has been further highlighted by the confluent crisis of the unrest in the United States, prompted by the murder of Black men and women in part of what is our crisis of institutionalized racism. So we are dealing with the confluence of these two crises, and I think one is ebbing and one we'll have to deal with for a long time to come. As I noted, we are now fewer than 100 patients in our health system or thereabouts, and we can get back to attending to the non-COVID related care in our population that needs to be done, as well as the care of the providers who've actually provided care during this pandemic crisis. We've, at the College of Medicine, completed our second week of a ramp up of activities, where in fact labs that have not been working on COVID-19 have started to do some work, and we've established collaboratories of groups of research labs that are interested in COVID-19. And these collaboratories are working at all levels of investigation, from the most basic to population science as it relates to this viral pandemic. We've been able to issue some requests for applications for seed proposals, thanks to the generosity of Mr. Michael Price and a challenge grant that he's given us. We've actually gotten some truly exceptional grants that have dealt with a number of different aspects of this crisis, including understanding the basic virology or the biology of this virus, which has informed the development of new treatments, biological treatments like antibodies, small molecules, helps us to understand the clinical predictors of disease, and studies of the complications of COVID-19, including the predisposition to developing blood clots, the development and the differences in the immune system in adults and children that may underlie the so-called multi-system inflammatory syndrome of children, as well as developing registries of patients and specimens that can be used for future studies, particularly focused on what are the underlying kind of mechanisms by which this virus disparately affected different patients in our population. And in that regard, it's a pleasure today to have Dr. Chinazo Cunningham with us to perhaps talk about some of these issues. Dr. Cunningham is a professor of medicine, family and social medicine, as well as the associate chief of the Division of General Internal Medicine. She is the director of the General Internal Medicine Fellowship Program and Diversity Affairs in the Department of Medicine. She has been a leader in the study and management of patients with opiate use disorders, not only in our community, but statewide and nationally. She is on the New York State Substance Use Guidelines Board and actually chairs that board, and is on the board of the CDC, again, for relevant topics related to substance abuse disease and injury. So without further ado, it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Chinazo Cunningham to speak a little bit about community health disparities and their heightened impact during the COVID-19 pandemic. Chinazo?
Great. Thank you so much. I'm really happy to be here talking to everybody this morning. So I am a general internist and also have board certification in addiction medicine. And before COVID-19, I really spent most of my time doing research, also seeing patients in one of our federally qualified community health centers in the South Bronx. And then also typically would spend about 4 weeks a year working in a hospital. taking care of internal medicine patients there. But during COVID-19, obviously, everything changed, and I was one of the first sets of physicians that was deployed to work in the hospital. So at the end of March, I was working in the hospital, and that was at the very beginning of the surge. And so it was a very crazy time. We sort of knew that we were in for this incredible experience, but there was so much that was still unknown at the time in terms of really what to expect, what the numbers would be, what the numbers of deaths would be or hospitalizations would be. There was a lot of discussion about the hospitals being overwhelmed, and it was really just the beginning. And then I subsequently spent another period of time in the hospital, and that was at the end of May, so just a couple weeks ago, and my experience was completely different because that was sort of the end of the surge when the curve was coming down and the number of patients hospitalized were decreasing by the day. So I've been a physician for over 25 years. I've worked through much of the HIV epidemic, and I've worked throughout the entire opioid epidemic, and that's really, those are really the areas of my expertise and research. I had never experienced anything like this with COVID-19, even with these other epidemics. It was truly, I truly had the worst day of my career ever in March. The system was completely overwhelmed. The city was completely overwhelmed. The state was overwhelmed. And there was a real lack of response from our leaders, our elected leaders. Everybody was scared. Patients were scared. Physicians were scared. Our trainees were scared. I had never seen fear in people's eyes like I did during that time. We really had no treatment. At that time, we weren't even doing studies because it was still the very beginning. We were sort of throwing everything we had from the kitchen sink in trying desperately to save lives. But we, at that time, I was not convinced that there was anything that was effective. It was also the time in which the hospitals changed their policies so that no visitors were allowed. So in addition to this fear that patients had, they were completely alone with no family members there to support them. And then to top all of that off, we really had a lack of personal protective equipment. And again, the whole system was unprepared from federal government all the way down. So to me, it was unbelievable to practice medicine in a setting like this. I mean, I work in the United States. I work in New York City. We are, you know, we have so much opportunities available to us and so many resources. And at this time, we really had very limited resources. In fact, we were practicing medicine as if we were a resource poor country. And so specifically for the personal protective equipment, literally what used to happen before COVID was that we would take a mask, an N95 mask, and we would use it for one patient and then we would discard it. But because we were now practicing in a resource poor setting, we used that same one N95 mask for my entire week in the hospital. So it went from going from one patient at one time to the entire week. And so just to, you know, that gives you a great example of really how different it was in terms of practicing medicine, sort of business as usual in New York or in the United States versus during the COVID-19 pandemic. So in terms of thinking about the disparities, one of the things that was really problematic even from the beginning was that we didn't really even know what was happening. We were scrambling to figure out who was being affected, what were the risk factors of those who were having poor outcomes. And so we started to learn, you know, people with diabetes had poor outcomes, or people with heart disease were having poor outcomes. But the data regarding race and ethnicity was very, very slow to be brought to our attention. And so it wasn't until we were well into the pandemic until we really started to realize the stark differences in outcomes according to race and ethnicity. So what we do know is that Black and Hispanics, and worse than Blacks and Hispanics, is that the minorities were more likely to have COVID-19. They were also more likely to be hospitalized for COVID-19 if they had the infection. They were also more likely to die of COVID-19 if they had the infection. And so all of these outcomes really showed that Black people compared to white people, or Hispanic people compared to white people, had poor outcomes all the way around. In addition, despite this, we also know that Black patients and Hispanic patients were less likely to actually get tested for COVID-19. And so what that means is, in fact, this is likely an underestimate of, in fact, what was happening, because people were less likely to get tested. And so there were probably even more cases, more hospitalizations, and more deaths than we understand. So trying to think through why is this happening? Why are more Black people or Hispanic people getting infections, getting hospitalized, or dying from COVID-19? And, you know, one of the things that we typically start to look at when we ask these questions in medicine is, well, what's going on with the patient? Oh, well, Black people are more likely to have diabetes than white people, so maybe that's the reason why. Or Black people are more likely to have heart disease than white people, so maybe that's the reason why. And that's the approach that we really take in medicine, is we look at the individual person. And often we tend to assign individual blame to people. So only if those patients had had a better diet, only if those patients had exercised more, only if those patients had taken their medications as directed better. But that's actually a very small part of the reason. And I think what's happened during COVID-19 now, and during the Black Lives Matter movement, is we're starting to have discussions beyond the patient and really looking at much larger issues as really contributing to these disparities. And so these issues are really structural issues and really have to do with structural racism. And so what I mean by that is looking at factors like housing and education and jails and prisons and immigration policies and who are our essential workers and employment opportunities for people. And so those are big concepts. And I know that that's sometimes hard to sort of link, oh, well, what does housing have to do with if somebody gets COVID or somebody dies from COVID? And so I want to give you a couple examples of how we saw this linked in individual patients. So when I saw patients hospitalized and they survived COVID and now they needed to go home and self-isolate, they sort of patients would look at me and say, what do you mean self-isolate? Well, you know, you shouldn't be around other people. You should isolate yourself for the next 7 days at least, so that your family members or the people that you're living with don't get infected. Well, I live with, you know, 4 people in a 1-bedroom apartment. How is that going to happen exactly? And I don't have an answer for that, right? I mean, other, you know, so we know that Black and Hispanic individuals are more likely to be housed in more densely housing areas and to have more people per housing, have multi-generations. So how do people isolate? It's nearly impossible. So that means then we're putting their family members at risk for getting infections. So that's one example. Another example is to say to another patient the same kind of thing, and the patient's thinking, well, I need to work. I'm an essential worker. I'm a bus driver, I work for the MTA, I work for the grocery stores or at a bodega. And if I don't work, I don't get paid. So patients then are forced to choose between working their essential jobs, which are often low paid wages, or not being able to make money for their families. And those are terrible decisions. We know that during this time with the lockdown that more fluent people and more white people are actually able to work at home. They have jobs that lend to working on a computer, internet access, computer access, et cetera. And so all of these structural issues really play into the risk of developing COVID and the risk of having poor outcomes from COVID. A few other examples include jails. I'm not sure if people on the call have heard, there was a lot of news about COVID infections in jails. So obviously people in jails are in very confined quarters. They have no ability to isolate. And once COVID entered the jails, it spread like wildfire. And so there were a lot of calls to decarcerate, to release people with very minor crimes so that they wouldn't be, you know, so they would reduce the risk of infection. And clearly people in jails have no control over their ability to reduce the risk for COVID. And so there are colleagues of mine, faculty at Einstein and physicians at Montefiore, who were really a big part of working with the jail system and making really calls to release people from jails. Otherwise, we know that there are going to be tremendous amount of death. And then lastly, around immigration policies, we know that people who are undocumented are going to be much less likely to seek medical care, so much less likely to seek testing and to seek care until it's much later in disease. And so they're much more likely also to have poor outcomes. So these are really ways that, you know, so none of these issues around the disparities in health outcomes when it comes to housing or jails or immigration policies or employment, none of these are new. We've been working in the Bronx. I've been working in the Bronx for 25 years. These are not new. I think the difference is that really COVID magnified now these differences. And in the setting of all of the murders of Black people by police, this has now really become much more of the conversation at the national level. And that's great. That's great that there's a much more willingness to talk about this and to really be, try to understand these sort of much more structural issues rather than individual issues. And so now I would say is the time for us to think about how we can actually change the course of how racism occurs in this country and how that affects people's health.
Great, Chinazo, that's a wonderful summary. Thank you so much. Perhaps a couple of brief questions for you. So given where we are, given our patient population, given our foundational mission of social justice, we do some of the things that we ought to be doing, but what are some of the other things that Montefiore and Einstein are uniquely situated to do in response to maybe not only even this pandemic, but some of the other issues that are related to the pandemic that you spoke about?
Yeah, so we, you know, so much of the reason why I came to Montefiore and Einstein is exactly because of this history and this mission, and it because it attracts people who want to work on these issues. And so I feel very fortunate to work at this institution and to have really tremendous colleagues who really want to sort of fight these fights and do this work that often isn't, you don't see in traditional healthcare systems or in medical schools. So we do have, we are working right now on many projects, and many people work directly with community organizations. So that's a really important place to start, right? So we need the community, we need to partner with the community. We need to listen to their voices, to listen to what they think needs to happen and partner with them using our unique knowledge and skills to help make policy changes. We need to partner with the city department of health, the state department of health, and with the federal agencies also in terms of rethinking policies. And so there are many people at Montefiore and Einstein who are actively involved in working with community-based organizations that serve people who use drugs, or community-based organizations that serve immigrants, or community-based organizations that serve people as they're being released from jails and prisons. And so I think we need to do more of that, and to really continue to push the policies and for policy changes around that. The area where I see where we really need to sort of up our game is more internally, actually, internally focused. And so this is a great time for us to sort of not only look at what we need to do in the community or sort of out there, but also inside our own walls. And so across the country, we know that Black and Hispanic people are really underrepresented when it comes to science and then when it comes to medicine, and so in terms of physicians. So one piece of data that is just crazy to me is that every year in the United States, about 400 Black men become physicians, 400. That number has not changed in decades. And if you think about, we have historically Black colleges and universities, and that we have a couple of them that are medical schools. And so of the 400 Black men who become physicians every year, at least half of them come from these historically Black schools. So then you take the other 200 medical schools across the country, 200, and that's an average of one Black man per medical school class. One. That's really hard to swallow. And so we have to think about how to change that. Einstein has been very involved in programs to help the pipeline. So for high school students or for college students, to give them opportunities in the summer to see, to work in the lab or to, you know, work around physicians, and that's really important, but clearly that's not enough. And so I think we have to really rethink admission policies, who gets admitted and why, you know, how much emphasis do we put on test scores, where we know definitely minorities test lower than white people, and really rethink, like, what, you know, what about other aspects of people's sort of careers or histories or characters, you know, do we value? And then, you know, can we increase the representation in terms of medical school? And the same thing is true for positions of leadership. And so we're incredibly fortunate to have Dr. Phil Ozwa as our, you know, CEO of Montefiore. And I mean, I really can't even name another Black man who's the CEO of a major medical center. But again, that's not enough. And so if you look at all the positions of leadership, all the department chairs, division chiefs, how many of them are minorities? The numbers are very, very low. And this is important because this all, you know, being in positions of leadership and being at the table changes the nature of the discussion, changes the nature of the questions that we ask or the solutions that we bring, you know, to try and address disparities. And so for me, that's a really important starting point where we can look within the walls of ourselves.
Great. So I think you're absolutely right. This is something that we, and not only we as Einstein Montefiore, but I think we as a medical community in the United States really do need to work on more. Getting back a little bit, perhaps, to COVID, you said that you experienced the worst day of your career during the surge. How and has this influenced you in any way in your approach to patient care or your approach more globally in medicine?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. First of all, I'm sure like many other people, I'm exhausted. I'm physically, mentally, and emotionally exhausted. Because this, what we're living today really takes up a tremendous amount of energy. And so, you know, I'm trying to focus on the other things that need to get done, or I'm trying to focus on sort of, you know, moving the needle in this way or that way, but it's actually really hard. It's because it feels like there's so many other big issues that are looming that are important to address. And so, you know, just acknowledging that it is, it's been difficult. It's been difficult for many ways. But I think in terms of changing my approach to patients, well, you know, I think that I have a tremendous amount of empathy. In a lot of ways, we're all in this together. 100% we're all in this together. Because as the patients were scared of COVID, so were the doctors. So was I. I mean, I isolated myself from my family for 2 weeks. I didn't touch the same silverware or glasses. I didn't sleep in the same beds. I didn't use the same bathroom. I completely isolated myself. And it was really, really lonely and really hard. And so it wasn't that, I mean, yes, I saw a different aspect because I was working as a healthcare provider, but in a lot of ways, all of the challenging aspects of COVID were challenging for me as well on a personal level or on my family or community level. And so I do think the sense of we're really in this all together and really having maybe a bit more understanding of what people are going through, because in a lot of ways I was going through the same thing.
Perhaps, thanks, and perhaps one last question. I'm sure that you've been speaking to your colleagues in other parts of the country. Any advice for them on how to manage what we've managed here in New York, either as a primary surge elsewhere or as a secondary surge? Are there specific things that you could tell people that might help them perhaps cope or manage a little bit better with a recurrence of this illness?
Yeah, I did hear from so many people from around the country, which was really nice. People were incredibly supportive. You know, people I had gone to medical school or people I grew up with. So that was actually a very nice aspect of this pandemic. But I think my biggest advice was sort of as I mentioned earlier, that because everything dramatically changed, that we really had to change our mindset in terms of practicing medicine in the United States. And we just had to get rid of this idea of practicing medicine in the United States and rethink practicing medicine in a resource poor area. And that fundamental shift in the brain of like, but we used to do this, but what about this? But what about that? It was like, everything has changed. That doesn't matter anymore. We're not gonna do that because what we're gonna focus on is saving people's lives. And so that shift was, you know, again, unlike anything I've ever experienced, but that was absolutely necessary to really focus on the task of helping keep people alive. I don't know if that's how it'll be in other cities or other states across the country, because my sense is hopefully we're better prepared now than we were in March. But depending on, you know, what happens or how big the problem is, that is definitely something that they may face.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. Hopefully we will be better prepared. So let's wrap up. I want to thank Dr. Chinazo Cunningham for being with us today and for her insights on COVID-19 and its impact on disparate communities. I want to thank everybody for joining us today, and we look forward to speaking to you again next week. So thank you very much. Have a great
week. And thanks for having me.